This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. On this Reporters Roundtable Thursday, let's turn first to my colleague Michael Puente, who covers news here in Northwest Indiana for Public Radio. Michael, thank you for being with us today.
Hey, thank you, Chris. How are you?
I'm pretty good. I'm pretty good. And as we start things out here, you've had some stories. In particular, let's start with the one of the real week, I guess, where we involved Governor Eric Holcomb. He had a chance to listen in to his State of the State message held before a joint session of the Indiana House and Senate in Indianapolis this week. It was his second one of his term of office so far. Tell us first a little bit about what the governor had to say.
Well, the governor talked a little bit about some, you know, workforce development issues. He talked about, you know, his education goals, economic development. We know economic development is always big in Indiana. And we know past governors have always tried to just sort of boast about Indiana's economy, the $2 billion surplus. So he talked a lot about that. He talked a little bit about, you know, the infrastructure goals of trying to improve Indiana's infrastructure, improving education. He didn't talk too much about the problems regarding the Department of Child Services. We know there are problems that persist there. And he talked a little bit about the opioid epidemic on how they want to tackle it. He stayed clear of any issues, social issues that his predecessor Mike Pence got into the weeds a little bit on. All in all, it was a pretty safe speech, and I think a little bit is that that's kind of the problem with Eric Holcomb. He doesn't seem like he wants to anger anybody. He wants to be everybody's best friend, and as we know in politics, not everyone's going to be happy, but as of right now, he seems to be playing it safe.
I recall that even before the speech, in one of the preview stories, the Indianapolis Star was hoping they'd get some indication of what the governor really had to say about the issues. They hadn't been able to determine it so far, and apparently didn't get that from his very first State of the State message last year. So they were hoping for something a bit more substantive, and I wonder now if they got what they wanted in this particular speech. It sounds like that may not have been the case.
That's right. You know, and one of the things I got to say, I was a little bit disappointed in that, like in any State of the State address, people do mention other parts of the state, and he did that. And he did not mention anything about Northwest Indiana. And it's kind of ironic because this is a governor who has visited Northwest Indiana on more than one occasion. And by all accounts, people, Democrats, especially in Northwest Indiana, have taken to the governor and have his approach in trying to make Northwest Indiana feel more a part of the state, they have applauded. And it seems like, though, it's a little thing, you know, but to hear maybe a Gary or a Hammond or some kind of reference in a speech that is going to be heard statewide, he didn't do that. I mean, he mentioned South Bend. He mentioned, other parts of the state. He did not mention Northwest Indiana. And I always cringe when a governor fails to mention this part of the state.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned earlier here about the fact that we didn't seem to hear very much until late in the speech from Governor Holcomb about the issues with the Department of Child Services. If you will, set the stage a little bit and tell us why even the DCS would come up for any discussion at all.
Well, as we know, recently Mary Beth Bonaventura, who of course is from Northwest Indiana, longtime juvenile judge, she was head of DCS under Pence and did a pretty good job. She stepped down, and with some pretty strident criticism being hamstrung in that department. So, and you got a lot of Democrats who are now jumping on this and saying, "Hey, children are in danger. There needs to be more money allocated." But Holcomb is taking a little bit slow. He made a decision to hire an outside consultant to review problems at the Department of Child Services, which to me seems a little odd in that if you don't know what's going on in your own department, that you need to hire an outside agency. And we're not talking about BMV. We're talking about children. We're talking about children who are in need around the state, primarily because of this meth situation and an opioid epidemic. Children are being put at risk. So it isn't like fixing something mundane. This is children. and who knows how long it's going to take. But, you know, apparently he feels that hiring an outside agent consultant to review problems there is the right move to do.
We're talking with Northwest Indiana Public Radio reporter Michael Puente about the stories that you had a chance to hear here on Lakeshore Public Radio. We first hear talking about Governor Holcomb and his State of the State address this week from Indianapolis. One of the other stories, in fact, that aired just yesterday and again today here, is talking about the issues that the Environmental Protection Agency is having to look into now about a former chemical operation in East Chicago. And tell us, if you will, set the stage for what the problems are that the EPA has had to delve into there involving DuPont.
Well, Chris, as we know, East Chicago has been in the news a lot over the past 2 years regarding a Superfund site and a public housing project called the West Calumet, which has been contaminated, the ground there, the grass contaminated with lead. And this area now is just south of that, somewhat adjacent to the Superfund site, but it's a huge, you know, more than 400 acres property that was used by DuPont for decades to develop all kind of products, but using very, very harmful chemicals. And now we're seeing that, you know, it's been a long time since DuPont has operated there, but there still is problems on that property. You name what, a lot of harmful chemicals there, including lead, and a lot of it has leached into the groundwater there. So now the EPA has come up with a plan to remedy that. And right now DuPont is on the hook to pay nearly $23 million of that. But the community there feels that that's not going to be enough, and that EPA isn't doing enough to address the contaminated water, and that there's fear that it could have gotten into other parts of the city, mm-hmm. including the adjacent neighborhood. So there was a meeting there last night. There's a public comment period about the cleanup work. I know the EPA says they're going to have another meeting about this sometime in March. People are upset, and it's just another one of these issues. Look, East Chicago has branded itself as the industrial capital of the world for more than a century. Well, there is a price to be paid for that, and a lot of it is environmental contamination, and it's going to take decades to clean up. And on the flip side is, you know, people who, you know, a lot of people had good jobs at those companies, but now, you know, their health may be affected by that, and it's going to take years before this property is cleaned up.
Now, and attending that meeting last night in East Chicago, how many people had a chance to speak out and tell the hearing officer from the EPA about this?
There was about, I would say, about 50 people there. I can't say all of them were East Chicago residents, but you had a number of concerned people from not just East Chicago, but from around the area. Who spoke up and, you know, gave their, you know, say to the EPA. Now, what the EPA is going to do, if they had a question, they're going to go back, answer that question, and get answers to everyone's concerns about that and get back to people. That's why they have this public comment period. So they were amenable to, you know, having people talk. I mean, people did, at least a couple of people brought up that, you know, the EPA seems to have been compromised a little bit in we hear on the national scale with the president talking about downsizing the EPA and talk about perhaps, you know, they're letting go a lot of their employees, and perhaps maybe science isn't really on the top priority at the EPA. But right now, we do got to give credit where credit is due. Under and it's ironic, there's like two sides to this. Under Scott Pruitt and under Donald Trump, the EPA seems to have been a little bit more direct and still taking East Chicago as a top priority in ways that, I got to say, even the Obama administration and even previous administrations did not. So at least, you know, I know it's sort of two sides to this. On the national scale, we do see, you know, issues with the EPA and in terms of how Donald Trump, the president, and Scott Pruitt, the administrator, is going to handle EPA. But from a strictly local focus, the EPA has been on East Chicago and seems to continue to make it a top priority. So you've got two sides to the coin there.
Yeah. And also, too, I know we are going to be all watching very closely here as you're going back to the national picture with the EPA and the change of how the staff is being handled with EPA nationwide. We know that they're looking for people to be able to fill positions with Region 5, which includes our particular area here in the Midwest. Right. So I guess we'll find out how the national picture of the EPA fits in better with the regional picture as well, too, won't it?
Well, that's right. That's right. We're always hearing rumblings that EPA wants to close its Chicago office. You know, I'm not one to, you know, be Rumorville, and but you know, we have heard talk about them downsizing or making like smaller offices in the Midwest to address problems. And we know people, especially in this area, know that you need a strong EPA. Mm-hmm. I mean, look what happened in terms of the contamination, the spill into Lake Michigan from U.S. Steel in Portage.
Right. I think that's the big concern because, you know, there are still problems and many more problems, even though they're trying to resolve some of these, as you just referred to now with the situation involving DuPont in East Chicago, but still a lot of problems there that have to be dealt with. They don't want to see the staff cuts make it more difficult to get these problems resolved, I would imagine.
You know, in the past, the EPA has always seemed like sort of the catch in terms of if in the Indiana Department of Environmental Management didn't catch or were lax on, mm-hmm. the EPA seems to have been the one, sort of the catch-all, the sort of safety net in case the state didn't do its job. And we know, you know, the track record of IDEM. It hasn't always been good.
No.
It's always been somewhat leaning towards what's best for business. And sometimes what's best for business isn't always what's best for the environment or for the long-term health of this area. So we need a strong EPA, and hopefully they're not going to go away. So, again, like we were saying, on a national scope, there are issues with the EPA. Locally, they seem to have still taken East Chicago and all of their environmental issues still as a top priority.
Michael Puente is a reporter here in Northwest Indiana covering public radio incidents, and we hear from him on occasion with some of the stories, in particular the two here involving the governor's State of the State message earlier this week, and then yesterday evening's public meeting involving the Environmental Protection Agency and DuPont, with their operation closed up in the East Chicago and how they're going to deal with the mess physically that they'll have on that too. And as always, Michael, thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Hey, thank you, Chris. Always a pleasure.
On this Reporters Roundtable Thursday, let's turn now to Meredith Colius-Pete, who covers a variety of stories, mainly education stories, for the Post-Tribune. Meredith, thanks for being with us on the program today.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start first here with the good news to people who are very concerned about how preschools in Hammond operate. We know that there's a state organization that offers time-to-time grants that will allow for preschoolers to be able to get the education that they need before they show up into the public school system. And we know that in particular that there's an organization in Hammond that is going to take advantage of a new grant. Tell us about that.
Sure, absolutely. Well, the Lilly Endowment just announced a grant that will fund about 138 or so new additional preschool spots. About 28 of those are slated for a preschool that is kind of run under the Woodmar United Methodist Church in Hammond. And so this is something that they're pretty excited about.
I would imagine. I think I may have driven past this place, the Woodmar United Methodist Church, and I wasn't even aware that they had a preschool in there.
Yeah, absolutely. And the director said also that that's one of the problems that they face as well, is that a lot of folks just don't know that they're there and they're mm-hmm. available to provide services. They've provided child care there apparently since about 1990, about 2016 or so, that they found that their numbers were dwindling a little bit, and they were responding to a lot of working parents, and so they kind of switched over and additionally decided to turn it into a preschool there.
Okay.
So it's kind of a small program, but the grant that they're saying would expand the number of students that they serve by about a third, which they believe is important, especially in the Woodbar neighborhood in Hammond, because, as you probably know, last June, the Rally Center at Purdue Northwest closed. Also, apparently, the YMCA that's just across the street from them once had a preschool program, and it closed there in Hammond as well. And so they're sort of hoping to try to fill in some gaps there in that neighborhood.
I'm glad you mentioned about the fact, about the Riley Center there at Purdue Northwest having to close here, and that's obviously put a lot of pressure on these other preschools around, like this one here in particular at the United Methodist Church. In doing your research on the story, tell us a little bit about what you found out about this Early Learning Indiana organization and how the opportunities that they have been able to put out there to be able to offer these grants.
Sure, absolutely. It's a nonprofit through Indianapolis, and it basically is looking for programs that provide what they feel is basically like a quality preschool education. You'll find in education research and things like that folks have really universally come to the conclusion, especially for low-income children who may be starting school with what's very famous, this vocabulary gap between them and, let's just say, middle-class students, that the sooner that you put a child in school, the better for them for their learning all through school, even through high school.
I know, too, that we've been looking forward to finding out more with preschool programs expanding, since we know the state has done the expansion. Lake County, of course, one of the pilot counties starting out in this expansion of pre-K, and it'll be interesting to see what support the state might be able to offer as well, too, along with the private nonprofit support.
Yeah, absolutely. The On My Way Pre-K program, it looks like last June was announced that it's going to expand from about 5 counties, and as you mentioned, Lake County was one of them, to about 20 counties around the state. A few years ago or so, former Governor Mike Pence turned down some federal funding that would have funded some pre-K programs as well, and his justification at that point was that he believed that they should look at pre-K programs that are proven to work before seeking that funding, and so the On My Way Pre-K is part of that now.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Meredith Colias-Pete, who is a reporter and writer for the Post-Tribune, and one of the other stories that you had featured in the newspaper as well as online is about how a Munster company has picked up quite a distinction being mentioned by Forbes magazine. Tell us about that.
Sure. Well, a sophomore from Munster High School was just named onto a Forbes 30 Under 30 list. Her name is Annie Ostojic, and she is a young lady that, by the looks of it, has been a very high achiever from an early age. She is a kid that has entered science fairs for quite a few years, has done very well for herself. She's been invited to visit the White House twice. Apparently, she's taking part in a Bill Nye documentary, for example, and so this is really just one more achievement for her.
And finally, here, if you will talk about, if this is related in a way to what our colleague Michael Puente had mentioned earlier in the discussion about the city of East Chicago. There have been problems with lead contamination, of course, in the city. And now we have a state lawmaker who is from East Chicago offering up his efforts to try to help the school city of East Chicago.
Right, absolutely. Senator Lundy Randolph has proposed legislation again this session to help the school city of East Chicago. Basically, what had happened is that when the lead crisis kind of was fully publicized, I believe that was probably back in a few years back, the EPA also found that a part of the parking lot in Kerry Gosch Elementary School, which was in the middle of the West Calumet neighborhood, needed some remediation. Not the school itself, but part of the parking lot. A couple of days really before school started, the superintendent came out and they announced that they were going to close that school as a precaution rather than have children go to school there. And then what they did was they took a state loan, an emergency loan, to renovate the former Westside Middle School, which, if you're familiar with East Chicago, is on Indianapolis Boulevard, basically across the street from Central High School. They renovated that building within a few weeks, got it ready for elementary kids. Did things like renovate the bathrooms for younger students and things like that. That particular building, the enrollment has been declining for a few years, and it was turned into a pre-K center for about last summer. So the problem for the East Chicago District, of course, was that this was a nearly $3 billion expense that they were not anticipating, combined with the drop of enrollment that came after the lead crisis. It's just been a longstanding financial issue. Senator Randolph, what he wants to do is basically to get state money to pay off that. It's about a $2.8 million loan or so. He had introduced similar legislation last year. There was talk later on in the session last year that some money would be set aside in the governor's budget, but that apparently didn't happen. And so this is kind of a second attempt for him to try to help out that district and get them some money for something that he says was not, you know, that it was not their fault that they were faced with such a situation.
And I know that you put in your story as well, too, Meredith, about the fact that this help, if it comes through from Indianapolis by way of the bill that was written and sponsored by Senator Randolph, is certainly going to come for the school city of East Chicago at a good time. They've had their share of problems dealing with financial matters, too, besides all the additional costs of having to deal with having to have Carrie Gosch closed and then relocate all the students into the remodeled building. They'd offered some opportunities that the public could have helped them out, I guess, in paying the bills, but it was not to happen here. And, of course, through that referendum that the school city of East Chicago had sought, that unsuccessful one.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. You know, in a way, they're sort of separate issues, dealing with the finances in general and then the finances that pertain to the lead crisis, if that makes sense. But yeah, he has definitely said that they're in a tough situation. The referendum that the district forwarded to voters last year failed, I think, about 4-1 or so by a pretty wide margin. And so this is... They certainly find themselves in a tough financial situation because of it. They've had to cut some staff due to the referendum, and so the district officials that we've talked to as well, just they obviously are hoping that the lawmakers are supportive of this.
That certainly could be the case, at least with we know that the administration is hoping to be able to get things back on track here now. They'd hope that the referendum would help them out, and I'm sure that this paying off of the $3 million or so for the loan concerning the remodeling of the school is certainly going to be very welcome and will at least kind of help out. In the meantime, they can concentrate on the other things that they wanted to concentrate on, to be sure. Meredith Colius-Pete is a reporter and writer for the Post Tribune, and she's been talking about the stories that she's highlighted in the print as well as online this recent week. Thank you very much, Meredith, for joining us today, and we hope to hear back from you soon.
Absolutely. Thanks, sir.
You're listening to Reporters Roundtable Thursday here on Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. Let's turn now to John Gard. He covers news in LaPorte County for his county newspapers, the Herald Argus in LaPorte, as well as the Michigan City News Dispatch, and he's with us from the newsroom there in LaPorte. John, thanks for being with us today.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's take up first here the latest news here about, and it's appropriate now because we know that the candidacy period is open now for those who are wishing to file to be candidates on the upcoming primary election in LaPorte County. And one of them is for county commissioner. Tell us about the latest candidate and a little bit about her and how she's gotten involved in the fray.
Yeah, that's right. We have a person who's running for office for the first time, Connie Grammarosa. She's been around in various roles in the community as a volunteer and in other efforts, but she announced her candidacy late last week, and she is so far the only candidate for the first district on the Republican ticket. There is the former mayor of Michigan City is running on the Democrat side for county commissioner.
Mm-hmm. Do we know very much about this lady and what she's done in the community?
Yeah, she owns a business, an antique home furnishing store in Michigan City. She's had that for about 2 years, but she's also got a farm out in the rural part of the county and near Rolling Prairie, and she's taken an interest more recently in the drug scourge that has affected the county, and she wants to take a more active role in making some change, she said.
I was going to wonder if she had any issues that she wanted to bring up and things that she wanted to concentrate on, not only in the campaign, but if she's elected come after the November election.
Yeah, she's got an interest in veterans affairs. She said her father was a Marine, and she understands that some of the difficulties that veterans have sometimes, and so she's quite interested in that, taking up that cause. She's involved with the local VFW, and she's also interested in, so many people are, in the opioid crisis, and seeing what can be done to stem that problem.
Now, from what you know right now, even though we know that the candidacy process is very early, as of just a few days ago, have there been any other people that are interested, or at least to kind of give them some indication that they might be interested in running for LaPorte County Commissioner?
Yeah, they're well, not for commissioner yet. Other than a couple of the incumbents have filed their candidacy, but for the county council, there have been there's a one matchup that's taken shape already after the first day of filing.
Wow!
There's a county council district one features a relative newcomer, a young guy named Justin Keel, who's from La Crosse, and he's going to run. He's got quite a bit of experience, though. He's a town councilman and is also on the NERPC board. He's a publisher of a couple of weekly newspapers here, and he'll be pitted on the Republican ticket against the incumbent, who is seeking his fifth term. So that'll be an interesting matchup.
I understand too that there was a former mayor, I think, that is interested, and who's gone out of the area, is interested, has come back and shown some interest in getting back into politics locally too.
Yeah, Sheila Brilson is she's running. She's a former mayor of Michigan City, and mm-hmm. she is expressed an interest in running. That'll be again. She'll be running against Grammarosa if Grammarosa wins the Republican ticket.
Now, we focused here basically on some of the major races, but there are a lot of other races that will be coming up in the primary election as well, too. Tell us about, in LaPorte County, those races, what people are interested in, and they probably will be watching as well.
Yeah, there are a lot of races. This is a big year for elections, 2018. And in addition to some of the bigger races, U.S. Senate, Joe Donnelly's seat is up for election, and he's seeking re-election. And there'll be a fight among the Republicans to challenge him. But there are quite a number of other seats. State representative, going through the list. I mean, there's prosecuting attorney, county sheriff,
wow.
You know, assessor. County council, county commissioner, and then all the township trustees and board members, and LaPorte County has the largest number of townships in the state at 21. So there'll be quite a few people seeking election.
John Gard's a reporter for the LaPorte Herald Argus and the Michigan City News Dispatch. And in fact, going to Michigan City now, one of the stories you covered was about a fire that happened in one of the governmental buildings in that city. Tell us about that, and if there's an update.
The Michigan City Courthouse is an old building. It's more than 100 years old, there was an electrical fire early Monday morning that didn't cause extensive damage, but it had to do with wiring that came into the courthouse, and some of the insulation was dried and cracked, and it caused arcing, and flames were visible, and this was discovered by a maintenance technician who was coming into work at 5:30 in the morning. So it was quite alarming, and it really points to the need for renovations at the courthouse, which had already been planned. It really exemplifies the need to make some of those renovations.
One of the other stories that you had covered for the newspapers there in LaPorte County during the time we have our bad weather stretch, and I know that we're looking forward, unfortunately, now to going back to some winter weather coming up in the hours ahead as we speak now. But tell us about what you found out in that the story from the problems of last week, and we go into our little thaw today.
Yeah, well, everybody was really glad to see the warm up, of course, and a lot of the snow has melted. But we really got a lot of snow in LaPorte and LaPorte County from Lake Michigan primarily. Sometimes that happens, as people know, the lake effect snow can really target specific areas, and it hit LaPorte really hard the first 6 days of January.
Has there been any word in looking into the forecast of what we're likely to get going into this weekend with this next spate of snow? And I guess it's more freezing rain, as I understand, this time around. Is it, from what you can tell from the forecasters, going to be a bigger problem than the snow has been there in LaPorte County?
Yeah, no, I don't know that lake effect will be part of the equation this time around, and it looks like, just from reports I've seen, that a lot of the worst snow will be south of us. Mm-hmm. But still, the cold will be an issue. I was looking at a forecast this morning that showed a low of, you know, single digits, 4 degrees by the weekend. So no one's looking forward to that. And of course, we've gotten a lot of precipitation already. 45 inches in the first 6 days of snow in the first 6 days of January. So I don't know that flooding will be an issue, but it's raining now, and most of that snow is gone. So any more is not going to help.
So I guess we're just going to have to watch how quickly the thermometer drops out. The bottom drops out of the thermometer, I guess, when the temperatures drop from the 40s and 50s, which we are at now, down to the teens, I suppose, by midnight tonight.
Right. Yeah. That's really dramatic.
We're talking with John Gard, who is a reporter for the LaPorte Herald Argus and the Michigan City News Dispatch, on the stories that he has put in the newspaper and online this week. As always, John, thank you for being with us, and we'll chat with you again soon.
Okay, nice talking with you, Chris.
Nice talking with you. And you're listening to Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio. Running a business requires smart decisions every day. Make a good decision for your company today and reach other businesses by sponsoring Regionally Speaking. Learn more about all the benefits. Call us at 219-756-5656. This is Reporter Roundtable Thursday here on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. And let's turn now to the conversation that we had this week with Andy Downs in the speech in Indianapolis. We've heard from Michael Puente about the governor's state of the state message on Tuesday, and we had a chance to talk with political analyst Andy Downs of the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics about that. Governor Eric Holcomb conducted his second State of the State address last evening to a joint Indiana House and Senate packed chambers there at the State House. And a little analysis on what was taking place last evening. We have Andy Downs, who is the executive director of the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics at IU Purdue. For now, anyway, Fort Wayne. And thanks for being with us, Andy, with an update and your take first off on what you heard from the governor last evening.
In many respects, it was a speech not unlike last year's speech. I personally keep waiting for the governor to do a little more patting himself on the back, so to speak. There were people who were wondering what he would be like as governor, and he's been viewed as a pretty successful governor so far, with Democrats willing to compliment him as well as Republicans willing to do so. But the speech didn't have a whole lot of here's what's going great in the state. I mean, it was a 30-minute speech, so it's not like it's packed the way a State of the Union address is. There's a little bit of that in there, and then more time spent talking about what he wants to see get done. And, of course, performance sometimes is the best politics, so maybe that's the reason that he keeps talking about what it is he wants to get done as opposed to patting himself on the back for what he has gotten done. I'm sure come 2020, we'll hear an awful lot of what he's gotten done. But my impressions about the speech beyond that really get to what he is trying to define, I think, as the most important issue this session, and that would be workforce development, very broadly defined. And he got there by talking about what sort of jobs have been coming to the state, what he hopes to have continue to come to the state, and then addressing what is perhaps our most important issue when it comes to workforce development, figuring out how to make sure we have the employees to actually fill the jobs that are being created here. We have a pretty low unemployment rate right now, and that may be one of those things that helps to turn off businesses from coming to the state, locating here, and creating more jobs.
In fact, I know, too, that even the whoever attended for the Indianapolis Star, as well as the Associated Press, and particularly the AP State House team, had mentioned the fact that they didn't see much boldness or leadership on the part of the governor in his address last evening. And the Indianapolis Star went into it in their previews before last night's comments, saying that they were waiting to hear from the governor. They wanted to get more indication of how the governor is going to be like here for the second term of office, or second year in his term of office, I should say.
Yeah, it is. It for a lot of people, it's a very boring speech. It's straight ahead. It's simple stuff. It's not rocket science, so to speak. Not much in the way of bold initiative. Some people are pointing to the initiative regarding infant mortality as perhaps the bold initiative this time around. But it's in keeping with what he said last year. It's in keeping with what he talked about on the campaign trail. And, you know, sometimes elected officials aren't particularly dynamic and exciting. A lot of people would point to someone like Eisenhower as saying there was nothing particularly bold in his administration. That might be a bit unfair. But he managed to keep things sailing in the right direction. And in some respects, when you look at low unemployment, when you look at growing wages, and when you look at jobs being created, there are a lot of things to say, just keep the ship moving in the same direction. Now, people can argue about every one of those facts that I just mentioned or find other facts to counter them, but there's enough of a case that someone can make that things are going well that the governor can choose to say, my job is just keep things going.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we know, too, that one of the most important things that people were waiting to hear more from the governor about, that I understand that he did mention in the final minutes of his address last evening, was talking about the problems at the Indiana Department of Child Services, the problems that were outlined by Mary Beth Bonaventura, the former director of the agency, as she was leaving office.
Yeah, that was a very scathing letter when she stepped down. And for a lot of people, they believe there should be some sort of action right now, that the legislature should engage in oversight. Democrats clearly are calling for that. And I think their calls for it go beyond the normal partisan bickering that we see from time to time in the General Assembly. I think that they really are curious about what has happened, and they want some answers to questions. The Republicans have chosen to back the governor's approach, and the governor's approach is an interesting one. It's one that's worthy of discussion in that a group has been hired to come in and take a look at what's happening and then to offer some recommendations, and sort of he's sort of taking a hands-off approach until then. But a lot of people say, no, there should be something happening now. We shouldn't have to wait for that report. There should be some hearings done right now so the General Assembly could choose to take action during the session as opposed to waiting until after the session. The governor's made it clear he's willing to call a special session if you think that's necessary. Yeah. So this is, you know, this is interesting. It may continue to bubble up in a way that forces the General Assembly to take action. For example, if there are some horror stories, if a child dies, or if there are multiple abuse cases that are really horrific that come to light in the next couple of weeks, it could be the General Assembly has no choice but to address them.
Yeah, I was going to say that we know that that Mary Beth Bonaventura had mentioned in her letter and some other comments as well too that most of her concerns about how the DCS was dealing with cases were because of the fact that we have the opioid crisis in Indiana, and even the governor kind of addressed that in his speech last evening about the fact that he wants to see some beefed up efforts and some different ways to approach the problem.
Yeah, the opioid issue is, unfortunately, it's a growing one. It's not one that's shrinking. We'll have to wait and see how these things work out. The opening of a couple of new clinics or several new clinics obviously will help, but people still have a long ways to travel, and there's always the issue of getting people to agree that they need help. You can't really force help on people in many ways. So we'll see what happens there. There's a lot of talk about it as an issue, but at the same time, other than opening some new clinics, other than the INSPECT database for pharmacists, some people I think are probably going to end up saying that really is not enough when it comes to opioid.
We're talking with Andy Downs, who is the executive director of the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics in Fort Wayne. He was there to hear what Governor Eric Holcomb had to say during his second State of the State message last night in Indianapolis. And I guess we should probably ask your reaction. First, let's get the expected reaction that we'll get from the Republican leaders of both houses. What do they seem to say about what they heard the governor say?
The leadership obviously loved what they heard. This is in line with what they're doing. It's helping to bring some focus to a legislative session that they admit could be a little chaotic. So they like it for that reason as well. The Democrats had the obvious criticisms. There's not enough in there in terms of specifics about the opioid crisis. There's not enough in there in terms of investigation into DCS. But there also are some places where there will be some common ground in terms of, for example, helping people who are in prison earn either a high school or college degree or post-high school training so that when they come out, they're actually much more employable than when they went in. So that there's room for agreement, which is what this governor has in his one session built a bit of a reputation for doing. Mm-hmm. But we'll have to wait and see how it plays out. It's an election year, but only for those who are in the House and the Senate, and half the members of the Senate, I should say. So it's not like it's 2020. It's not like they have to worry about, the Democrats have to worry about trying to tear down Holcomb while the Republicans have to worry about propping him up. One of the things I'm waiting to hear, though, is actually from those within the Republican Party who are looking for a little more action on social issues, because that was pretty much absent from the state address.
I was going to ask you if what you've seen so far, I know that we're very early into this 2018 General Assembly session here, but what has been said so far about whether any measures are going to come up here or dealing with some of these social issues that you referred to?
Well, they're certainly going to come up, and some of them a bit more likely to come up than others. Obviously, the alcohol issues are in some way, shape, or form are going to come up. We've had chairs of committees already say they're going to give certain things hearings. The stuff that's a bit more contentious, for example, from over my way, Kurt Nisely introduced some legislation that would basically ban all abortion. That's probably not going to get a hearing. Mm-hmm. The argument that supporters of that legislation are making is that it's time for a case to make its way to the Supreme Court. And the reason they're making that argument is because people, even those who are pro-life, many of them are saying that's clearly unconstitutional in the current definition of the Supreme Court justices. But, you know, those who want the more rigorous definition or more restrictive definition are saying, no, it's time to send something to the courts. Let's be the case that gets there. Let's be the state that sends the case there. So there's going to be a lot of talk about that, but I'm not sure there will be hearings. A lot of people remember that last year, one of the chairs of the committees, who is a pro-life, card-carrying pro-life member of the Republican Party, refused to give a bill a hearing because he said that it's just clearly unconstitutional, and people actually picketed his church. Mm. So, you know, there is a growing tension here that both Long and Bosma, as well as the chairs of the committees, are going to have to try and navigate, and whether that means giving some opportunities for hearings without votes, whether it means putting some things up for votes, we'll have to wait and see how that plays out.
And one other area, too, that we haven't heard from, at least not yet anyway, is from the LGBTQ community and the activists that have been out there. They have wanted to push for some more efforts made again, dealing with the things like RFRA. I'm sure that probably will get slipped into the session, too, if there's time.
Well, it will. I mean, people will talk about it. There are a lot of folks who actually, in response to RFRA, saw local governments taking action.
Right.
And so some folks said, all right, fine, I'm just going to focus on my community, see if I can get my community to adopt some legislation. But that certainly didn't stop the statewide effort from saying, we need something to happen at the state level. Republicans, you know, they said they were going to give something a chance the year after RFRA. The legislation failed very quickly and without a whole lot of fanfare. And they can say, we gave it a chance. We can set that issue aside for right now. But it probably will come up again, as will hate crimes and a couple of other things, but probably not in the substantive way that something like Sunday sales will get.
So maybe in looking back now at what had happened before the joint session of Indiana House and Senate, no big surprises from Governor Holcomb, certainly. A lot of his efforts for his agenda for this particular session mentioned, as you mentioned as well, too. And if anything else gets added to the mix, I guess we'll just have to wait and see, eh?
I think so. You know, every session we think we know what's going to happen. We think we know what the big issues are going to be. And on a pretty frequent basis, something surprises us. So there's always still that thing for us to wait and get surprised by. But things are taking shape, and obviously they're meeting and starting to get things done for us in the state. But we'll have to wait and see. We have many weeks to go still.
Andy Downs is the Executive Director of the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics at Indiana University, Purdue University, Fort Wayne, soon to become Purdue University, Fort Wayne. As always, Andy, thank you very much for being with us to give us your take on what the governor had to say during his second annual State of the State message last night.
Thank you very much for having me.
The competitive video game industry known as esports is booming these days. Reports are estimating that the global market will top $1 billion in the next 2 years. Colleges are trying to deal with how to treat it. And as Indiana Public Broadcasting Lindsay Wright tells us, some athletic programs are jumping on board and others are holding out.
During a typical sporting event, you might hear balls bouncing, helmets colliding, but listen. Clicking, typing. This isn't your typical sports team. It's an esports team. Indiana Tech added the varsity program at the beginning of this school year. Head coach Jeffrey Wright says they're even offering partial scholarships to recruits.
We have several students from California, some from Texas. You know, I'm from Georgia. It's a melting pot because it is so new. A lot of people are jumping on this opportunity as it becomes like a new phase in sports at college level.
Most of the players focus on a game called League of Legends. Player Logan Fisher explains it as simply as he can.
You take 10 people, 5 on each team, and whoever knocks down the other person's base first wins.
Their fingers move at high speeds. For sophomore Daniel Kellogg, that comes rather easy.
I played a lot of piano back in the day, so my fingers can naturally move that way.
But Kellogg says learning new moves takes practice, just like any other sport.
Let's say I gotta press this key and that key at the same time, right? It takes about 3 months to get used to because you naturally wanna do something else, like flex your fingers differently.
Competitive gaming is spreading like wildfire, even at the collegiate level. Reports project esports will be a $1.5 billion industry worldwide by the year 2020. The National Association of Collegiate Esports launched just a year and a half ago. Michael Brooks is the executive director. He spoke to me over Skype and says the nonprofit has grown from overseeing 6 varsity teams to 53 since it began.
And these schools are all different sizes, different types. Some of them are, huge state programs. Some of them are small private schools. Some of them are schools that have never had an athletics program at all.
Despite the growing popularity, Brooks says esports is often described as the wild, wild west. It's a broad activity, and he says it's difficult to organize. Change is coming, but slowly.
It's really elevating collegiate competition from what the club level is, which is, it could be a group of 5 friends who get together and form a team and compete on behalf of their school, to really looking at an organized and resource group to compete at the highest level for their institution.
He says as more institutions get on board, naturally, more resources follow. But one of the big snags teams face is administrators. That's the challenge the Indiana University Gaming Club in Bloomington is up against.
Dragon, dragon, dragon. Just back off, back off.
The group practices once or twice a week, usually at home. They don't have a dedicated place to play. A lot of the players received a small scholarship last year through a Big Ten tournament. But Coach John Mundell says having IU's support would be a game changer.
Things that can make like the quality of life, or I guess for the players, to be a lot easier, or helping us like do whatever we need to do, like giving us funding to go to tournaments.
Mundell says he doesn't expect the kind of resources Indiana Tech has. At this point, he'd just like administrators to be more open to a conversation about esports. The future looks promising. Industry leaders say the growth speaks for itself. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Lindsay Wright.
And researchers at the University of Notre Dame working on a program with community college students have found that those who receive mentorship support had a greater chance of completing an associate's degree than those who didn't. Here's Jennifer Weingart with some details.
For the Stay the Course program, Notre Dame partnered with Catholic Charities of Fort Worth, Texas, to pair students with social workers to address the underlying causes of dropouts. 3 randomly assigned groups of low-income, at-risk students received either emergency financial assistance and mentorship support from a social worker, only the money, or were in a control group which got neither. Students in the full support group were about 15% more likely to graduate in the 3-year period of the study and 25% more likely to still be actively working towards their degree. They also found that receiving only emergency financial assistance didn't make a substantial difference in students' graduation rates. Study co-author Jim Sullivan says the next step is an expansion to more colleges to test the theory elsewhere.
The key is this something that only works given the provider in Fort Worth, Texas, and the population of Fort Worth, Texas, or is this something that could have real substantive impact in communities across the country?
Sullivan says they plan to start programs at 8 or 10 colleges in the fall. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jennifer Weingart.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. And for this week, I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. And many thanks to the reporters who have been with us today on the program for this Reporters Roundtable Thursday. Northwest Indiana Public Radio reporter Michael Puente. From the Post Tribune, Meredith Colias-Pete. And from the Herald Argus and the News Dispatch in LaPorte County, John Gard. And, of course, we thank Andy Downs, who is, of course, with the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics at IU-Purdue-Fort Wayne, with his take on the State of the State message this week. And we hope that you'll join us next week as we bring you another week of Regionally Speaking programs. On Monday, we'll hear from Lake County Sheriff Oscar Martinez, Jr.